You're all very welcome to tonight's event at the Forum. My name is Beth Hannan and I'm the Associate Director of the Forum. If you don't know us, we are a non-profit organisation. We put on debates and panel discussions like tonight's once a week during the academic year. We bring philosophers and other thinkers, researchers together to discuss academic ideas as they relate to contemporary life. We're able to do this because of the generosity of our donors, as well as the fantastic support we get from the LSE, for which we're incredibly grateful. If you too would like to be one of those amazing, generous people and donate to the Forum, you'll find a link to our Just Giving page on our website. You'll also find a huge archive of podcasts of our previous events, as well as essays by contemporary philosophers, again, on issues relating to contemporary life. Just a couple of tedious housekeeping matters. If you could turn the volume off on your phone, that would be really appreciated. I say this every week, and there's always one. But you don't have to turn the phone off. In fact, you're more than welcome to tweet along with me and other people. We have a hashtag LSEFEP if you are into that kind of thing. And we have roving mics going around, so if you want to ask a question, do wait for the mic to find you before you ask your question so everyone can hear it, and also so that it's picked up for the podcast. So also be aware that if you ask a question, it will be recorded on the podcast. Okay, that's it for me. I'm going to hand you over to our fantastic panel, and thanks for coming out on Halloween night.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, Beth. Welcome to Future Sex at the LSE Forum for European Philosophy. I'm Shahida Bari. You can call me Shahida. I'm a fellow of the Forum and your chair for the evening. Just an extra bit of housekeeping. Rebecca Riley Cooper is sadly unable to attend today, and she passes on her apologies to you. And I hope that won't mar your interest in what I think is bound to be a really powerful and pertinent discussion. We certainly have a panel teeming with ideas and argument. This debate comes in a year of heated discussions about rape culture, consent, harassment, the merits of sex positivism, trans identity, and its relationship to feminism, and all the perennial questions and debates that we have about the legalization of prostitution, the uses and abuses of pornography in our digital age, etc. In this debate, we ask, what is the future for sex and sexuality? Have the rules of sexual engagement changed in the 21st century? And have academic disciplines managed to keep up? How do we start thinking afresh about desire after Freud and into the future? Or are there lessons, we might find out, still to be learnt from the past? And what is the future for sex as our conceptions of the body are reframed by culture, bionics, and even the law? So our three panellists are Catherine Angel is the author of Unmastered, a book on desire most difficult to tell, published by Penguin Allen Lane. She's also a lecturer in creative writing at the University of Kingston and is completing a second book on subjectivity and selfhood in contemporary sex research. She studied at Cambridge and Harvard universities and has held fellowships at the University of Warwick and Queen Mary University of London. Her writing has appeared in The Independent, Prospect, The New Statesman, Aeon and Five Dials. She reviews for the TLS and Poetry Review. Kate Devlin is a senior lecturer in the Department of Computing at Goldsmiths University of London. Sadly, she hasn't brought any robots with her, but I'm sure she'll be able to give us some graphic accounts of what her robots get up to. She did start as an arts and humanities scholar and now works in the fields of human-computer interaction and artificial intelligence. She investigates how people interact with and react to technology in order to understand emerging and future technologies. She's currently focusing on cognition, sex, gender, and how these might be incorporated into cognitive systems such as sexual companion robots. Sexy robots on the one that we put as the image of our talk. I don't know if you noticed. He looked like he had baked bean tins for elbows, but sexy robots. And if you're interested, she's running a conference called the Love and Sex with Robots Conference here in London at Goldsmiths on the 19th to the 20th of December with the unforgettable URL loveandsexwithrobots.org. Van Riddell is a cultural historian who specialises in the entertainment, sex and the suffragettes of the Victorian and Edwardian eras. She studied at Royal Holloway and King's College London. She's an AHRC BBC Radio 3 New Generation thinker, and she's written for The Guardian, BBC History and Times Higher Ed. She's also the author of A Victorian Guide to Sex, which takes a light-hearted look at the sexual ideas and advice that helped to build an empire, from sex dolls to suffragettes. If that doesn't sell your book, I don't know what will. Okay, our panellists have been asked to speak for 10 minutes, and they'll outline various positions and ideas and thoughts. Rather than have a pile-up of papers with you all straining with the weight of ideas and arguments, I'm going to park and pause after each speaker. I'll pose some questions, and I'll encourage the other panellists to speak to each other. And then I'll also ask some broader questions to them all at the end of the three papers, and we'll open up to the floor as soon as we can. Sound good? Good, good nod. Okay, Fern is going to kick us off.
Thank you. And I'm sorry for filling in at the last minute. Apologies if this is a bit of a ramble. I have
warned delighted
everyone. But I'm going to start our discussion on future sex by actually taking us into the past. As a Victorianist, I work specifically on sexual attitudes and female agency. And one of the things that frustrates me so much about our modern sex culture is how much we hold up the Victorians as being responsible. We say they're prudish, we say that they're to blame, we say that we are reacting against them. And actually, looking back at our sexual cultural ancestors, Victorians were much better at sex than we were. They had much better ideas on female pleasure and much clearer ideas on how important equality in a relationship, a sexual relationship, was. Which may surprise you if you hold on to the main idea that many of us have in our culture of the Victorians as patriarchal and anti-women. Now, one of the reasons this has come about is because in the 1860s, we had something called the Contagious Diseases Acts, and they were three acts passed in the late 1860s that regulated STDs. It was a huge plan that we were going to solve the STD crisis in Britain. But the target was seen to be women. And this is because any of the investigations into the causes of STDs were deemed as immoral and demoralising to men, which might strike a chord with some of you if you've seen any of the papers and any of the articles in the last week on how they've cancelled the male birth control trials because men are suffering from depression. Now, any woman in the room on birth control is going to tell you we've been dealing with this problem since any of us started on birth control. But because men have reacted to it, the trials have been stopped. Now, for me, this is really a repeating cycle, going all the way back to early sexual regulation culture, which is in the Victorians in the 1860s. And the reason why the Contagious Diseases Act came about was because the Army and the Navy were losing about a year's worth of labour to men suffering from STDs. And they went in and they tried to analyse and try to figure out how to solve it. And it was found to be far too much of a problem for the men in the Army. It was very embarrassing. So the target became the women that they were sleeping with. It became their prostitutes. It became wives. It became women that they were in relationships with that they weren't married to. And from this point, every bit, at least in my mind, of sexual regulation culture that we are still dealing with today has come. And so that's a very kind of obvious moment of sex regulation. But one of the problems I've always faced as a historian is that's been the dominant view. I think a lot of history is built on legal laws, not on culture, not on what people's actual experiences were. And when you're looking at sex culture in the Victorian period, it's completely different to the regulation. In 1860, we have something called The Art of Begetting Handsome Children published. And it's fantastic. It's a tiny little pamphlet. I found one copy left in a museum archive. But it goes into graphic detail on foreplay, on the importance of the female orgasm. And as a researcher, it was revelatory because it exploded this entire perception that you find in many Victorian sex guides, that you find in many Victorian culture guides, that the female orgasm was all important because it was the only way you got pregnant. That was how you got pregnant, was if a woman was going to have an orgasm. And so all of the sex information that's being published in the Victorian period is geared towards female pleasure. And this is something we've completely forgotten. So why is it today, if the Victorians knew 100 years ago that female pleasure mattered, we're writing books about how much female pleasure mattered, we're saying in the marriage guides that sex is the union of a soul within a soul, how have we got to where we are today, and what is the future going to hold for us? I am increasingly concerned that we are moving from an erotic culture into a pornographic culture, and a huge amount of our sexual culture today is geared purely on sex robots. Wow. In an idea that we lose the intimacy from sex, we're losing the connection, almost the poetical, the imagination, the erotic culture that the Victorians had that we don't seem to have. And I think discussions like the debates that we're going to have today are incredibly important to reassess both our past and our future. And that's where I'm going to end, if that's okay.
Fabulous. Yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask a slightly facetious question, which is, how naughty were they, the Victorians? Do you have examples?
I have so many examples. I wrote a book of examples. That's how many there
Sex
are.
Dolls and suffragettes.
And
I've
yes, yeah. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it all in.
Are there diagrams?
There are diagrams. There are examples. We have, if you're looking at Victorian sex culture, start at the top, really. So we have Queen Victoria's son, who marries the fantastic Alexander of Denmark. He has a sex chair built for him in the brothels in Paris that we can still see today that's in the Universal Museum, that's for use with two women. And you have his wife, Alexandra, who is a supporter of something called Vigo's horse action saddle, which is amazing because it's supposedly to ride your horse indoors, to help you learn how to ride your horse indoors. And it is literally a horse saddle on a vibrating box with three different speeds.
Nice. Okay.
Now,
intriguing.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that is so fascinating about the Victorian world is we say that they don't know what the female orgasm was, we say that they don't know what the clitoris was. They knew all of this. The sex toys from the Victorian period are a thing of beauty. They're beautiful, they're silver, they're ornate. You know, this is not a time where people didn't know what a dildo was or didn't know what sex dolls were. Victorians had a sex doll called the Femme de Voyage, which the advert of is just ridiculous because it's the ultimate line from it is the most important part of a woman can be taken away and stored in a hat. So, if you think of all those Victorian top hats and the hat boxes, you never look at one in the same way after that. But it's this, you do see a huge amount of a discussion about masturbation, which they're worried by, but equally everyone seems to be doing. There are lots of warnings about how dangerous masturbation is, because for men, it will make your penis very thin and flaccid. For women, it will make your vagina look like the ears of a spaniel.
Thanks.
Now, I'm not reading these things in pornographic pamphlets that maybe had an audience of 50 that are privately published. I'm reading and finding these things in medical manuals and in marriage guides that are universal, that are specifically being published for young married couples. And that, for me, really changes and really challenged my perception of how Victorian sex culture was made. And I really have questioned in the last few years, if they were so open about sex, how have we got to where we are today?
Yes. Yeah. Is the end point that you get to that they were happier, freer in their sex lives than we are? I say that because that about this Contagious Disease Act that is dedicated towards producing a healthy population. Those of you who know Foucault, of course, know this is the argument of biopolitics at the point of the regulation of sex is to produce a healthy workforce. And we should talk about the relationship of sex to capitalism, of course. But the inverse, the modern kind of correlation is, of course, that sex is, that we're very anxious about population control, and that sex is about not producing a healthy population, but producing a limited population or curtailing that. So I wonder if you think that the Victorians were happier than us and freer than us.
Well, there's almost a twofold answer to that, in that the arguments around birth control really are present from 1812 onwards, when the first birth control pamphlets are being published. And what challenges our knowledge of birth control is feminism. And one of the amazing, worrying and challenging moments as a woman who works on this was discovering that in the middle of the Victorian period, there was a huge amount of knowledge on birth control, a huge push for birth control, and yet it was the feminist movements who said, no, we don't want this. To talk about birth control, to look at birth control, makes you a bad woman. It means that sex will be freer and men will have more sex with prostitutes and will not remain faithful. And that was almost a hallmark of the feminist reaction to the Contagious Diseases Act. So in arguing whether or not the Victorians were freer, on the one hand I would say yes, very much so, because they had a much more diverse discussion of sex culture than we've ever explored, really? And we've ever acknowledged.
Wow.
But in terms of, do I think their attitudes were correct and right? No, they had deep flaws as well. And I think that the issues surrounding how feminism has regulated sex culture is a really important one. And we see it from the very start of the early feminist movements in the 1860s onwards.
Kate and Kathy, could I invite you to respond? Did you have any thoughts?
Or? Yes.
Loads.
I don't even know where to start. Where will I go? Okay. I really like the thing about, you were talking about moving from an erotic to a pornographic culture. And one of the accusations that comes up in terms of the sex robot argument, I'll more on that later, but it's essentially that it is a very pornographic thing, that you cannot have emotional intimacy with a machine. I'm not entirely convinced that that's the case. I think you can form attachments and bonds to things. It's not reciprocated yet, but if we eventually have machines that are conscious, machines that are sentient, and it's not inconceivable, it may not be in the form, the human form that we anticipate, but we may have machine sentience, machine consciousness, then with that could come intimacy, and with that could come some kind of affection and love. And so, which is one of the reasons why the conference we're doing is called Love and Sex with Robots, because there is this attachment, and I don't think it necessarily has to be just a purely pornographic approach. I think there can be room for eroticism. It's just redefining what that is. And with current technology like virtual reality is becoming very much driven by the porn industry. And there's a lot of sex toys you can use. It's an area of research called teledildonics, where you can hook yourself up to all kinds of sex toys and go in a VR world and feel those actual bodily responses. And you can do it co-located, so you can have someone on the other side of the world with a sex toy, you with your sex toy, and you can have joined sex over the internet. And so there's room for intimacy there, there's room for eroticism there. It's just that you're using the technology to advance that. So I think there's still space for eroticism and technology, but I agree to an extent that this is a much more pornographic approach these days, because it's much more widely available, possibly.
I would agree with that, but I think I'm very old-fashioned in this way, in that where we are at the moment, I think we have lost our ability to look at the intimacy that comes from two people. And as we're shifting towards a more heavily pornographic culture, we're losing that human connection, and we're also losing education about that human connection. So, I mean, the sex toy, the womanizer, I don't know if anyone's seen this on BuzzFeed. It came out a few days ago. And it's an oral sex toy for women that's supposed to make you come in under 3 minutes. which sounds great. It's being marketed as very successful, very expensive, of course. But it's an idea that, A, the sex toy will somehow bestow your womanhood. It's called the womanizer. This will make you a woman. And also, it's a push that female sexual pleasure is, again, female responsibility. And while I agree with that to a point, I also think we're losing a discussion on how to have sex with your partner. And it's moving much faster towards how to have sex with a machine, how to have sex with an inanimate object. And we've lost, there's almost a hiccup in that we had a very heavily erotic culture of have sex with another human being, which also had a number of inanimate objects and sex toys involved in it. But there's no catch up, you know. We've now the technology is taking over and the intimacy is being left behind. And I think that's a fear that I have.
I've got a suspicion that Kate's going to have a really tomorrow's worldy, techie riposte to that. I'm going to encourage you to keep your Tinder dry for when we get to your position. Catherine, shall I get you to do your paper? Would you like to respond?
I can respond, but maybe I can bring that in later.
Great. Okay, so Catherine.
Okay, can you hear me? Okay, I might just get nearer. Okay, so I'm going to talk about female sexual dysfunction, which is a kind of umbrella term for a range of conditions that is classified within the American Psychiatric Manual called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, that I'm sure many of you have heard of because it's quite a controversial document. So in the realm of pharmaceuticals, the future is always king. And in the realm of sexual pharmaceuticals in particular, the future is a bright, shiny place where sexual joy will be achieved through a levelling of the pharmaceutical playing field. Since men have Viagra and women have what exactly? Viagra's blockbuster success at the kind of turn of the millennium for erectile dysfunction led to a pharmaceutical rush to test Viagra and similar compounds in women with sexual problems. And the hope was that just as in men, perhaps so too in women, a vasocongestive drug, i.e. one that increased engorgement and blood flow and swelling, the kind of hydraulic expansive metaphors were very popular in this period, would yield a blockbuster drug for women too, and for Pfizer or some other pharmaceutical company. And as it happened, Viagra failed pretty miserably in women. And this failure yielded to an insistence on the complexity of female desire and the female brain, since, irritatingly, an increase in vaginal lubrication seemed to have very little impact on women's desire to have sex in the first place. And so other possibilities were excitedly formulated by many pharmaceutical companies. Intrinza, a testosterone patch that was licensed in Europe but not in the US, but has been since withdrawn from the market. A testosterone gel called Libigel, and more recently, flibanserin, that was then renamed Addy, which was a failed antidepressant, allegedly working on the vaguely worded desire centres of the brain. And flibanserin has had a kind of patchy career. It was eventually licensed by the FDA in the US. It's had low sales, it's very expensive, many insurers don't cover it, and there have been lots of controversies over its safety because of its quite considerable side effects. So we're in the realm here of promissory technologies, as sociologist Nicholas Rose has described them, technologies that hypothesize a future where the problems of human life will be resolved if only we can trust the technocratic processes enough to ensure that that future can come about. Now, in response to the kind of pharmaceutical hyperbole and the aggressive marketing campaigns, a robust feminist critique has emerged. And part of that critique points to the very big kind of ethical problems in how the pharmaceutical industry operates. But the critique has also argued that this kind of troubling medicalization of women's sexual problems relies on a vision of sexual function which is overly linear and mechanical. So the critique suggests that the vision of sexual function is one where you have desire, which then leads to arousal, which then leads to usually penetrative penis in vagina sex, which then leads to orgasm in some form or other. And then any glitch in that sort of linear procession of events is seen as a dysfunction that's ripe for a solution by a pharmaceutical drug. The feminist critique has also argued that this vision of sex is very reductionistically biological. in that it ignores all the complex and often political and socioeconomic phenomena that can lead to sexual difficulties. So problems to do with education about the body and anatomy and function, communication problems between partners, questions of safety, of violence, of abuse, questions of tiredness due to disparities in work and care, difficulties of self-image for women in particular, etc., etc. So all phenomena that can be seen as related to women's social and economic status. The critique insists, in fact, that low sexual desire of the kind that pharmaceutical companies want to pathologize need not necessarily be seen as a dysfunction, since it can be seen as an inevitable and perhaps adaptive reaction to these kind of life circumstances. And in addition, the feminist critique argues that low desire might only be seen as a problem because we're using the wrong model of desire for women, namely a model that's based on men. So in earlier editions of the DSM, the psychiatric manual, diagnoses of low desire assumed a spontaneously arising desire for sex or fantasies about sex from which arousal would follow. And if you didn't have that experience of desire for sex and fantasizing about sex, you had low desire. But in fact, there's quite a lot of research that reports that women don't have regular sexual fantasies in this way, and that many women often experience sexual desire as a state that emerges in response to stimulation and ensuing arousal. So Rosemary Basson has been a very influential figure in this area. She has described what she calls an incentive motivation model, which argues that women most often engage in sexual activity not because of an intrinsic desire for sex, but from a state of sexual neutrality. She suggests that women are primarily motivated by non-sexual reasons, such as a desire for emotional closeness. And so, the argument goes, we over-pathologize women with low desire if we assume that their sexuality functions on this linear model of desire leading to arousal. And so the most recent classification of the DSM, the DSM-5, that came out a couple of years ago, reclassified sexual problems along these lines and emphasized the responsivity of sexual desire in many women. And the previous diagnostic category that was called hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which basically means low desire, was replaced by one called female sexual interest / arousal disorder. Wonderful, beautiful, elegant terms, I'm sure you'll agree. Psychiatrists are not generally the best writers. Now, I think that this kind of perspective can be valuable since it's good to widen the models of sexual desire that we use. But I think it's also very problematic. And it's instructive, I think, that there is now in the DSM no category for women which includes the word desire. So there was hypoactive sexual desire disorder, and now there is no category that uses the term desire for women. So in this DSM, women can't have a desire disorder. They can have an interest / arousal disorder. But men can have desire disorders. They can be diagnosed with hypoactive sexual desire disorder. And this might be because desire is a kind of baseline state that we ascribe to men. And we see a lack of desire in men as already an anomaly, already something pathological. And so for me, the question is whether a lack of desire is actually becoming something definitional for women. So the emphasis on responsivity, so on sexual desire in women as emerging in response to stimulation, also, I think, has a very fraught ambivalence to it. And again, it might be an important part of avoiding pathologizing female sexuality by seeing it, by assuming that it's equivalent to male sexuality, albeit a male sexuality that isn't interrogated in a lot of this literature. But in the process, again, I think this emphasis on responsivity can reinscribe troubling clichés about men being the ones who have a reliable and mechanical sex drive and being the ones who want sex and ask for sex, who push for sex and who encourage women into sex, and clichés of women as those who, after weighing up their non-sexual interests, their perhaps more socially sanctioned noble interests such as love or intimacy or motherhood, may be then talked into sex. And I think the shift to interest as opposed to desire is also very telling, because the term interest speaks of notions of incentive and reward of the kind that evolutionary psychology has much favoured with its highly gendered politics of female sexuality as a kind of goal-focused and service-oriented behaviour. I will be a good waitress, you will give me a good tip. I will give you some sex, you will give me a diamond and your loyalty. And I should say that the literature in this area is overwhelmingly and depressingly heterosexual in its focus. And in fact, this kind of cognitive and rational conception of behaviour, this emphasis on interest, also chimes with a tendency I think we see in many places, which is to seek explanations for sexuality in women and for desire in women, a tendency that we don't tend to see for men. So books and articles called Why Do Women Have Sex have a kind of currency that I think is only valid if you believe that men have sex drives, whereas women have interests that they weigh up in a kind of cost-benefit analysis. So this kind of naturalization of low desire that is happening in the critique of psychiatry and this new emphasis or renewed emphasis on sexual desire as responsive in women can be understood, I think, in two important ways. The first is as a way to negotiate what's seen as our very troubling contemporary landscape around sex and women. So I think the feminist critique wants to resist what it sees as a naive and post-feminist culture that's insistent that sex is naturally liberatory, a culture that perpetuates the sexualization of young girls and that doesn't understand how to articulate a political critique of pornography. So psychiatry, in promoting a picture of sexuality as linear and reliable, and in understanding a lack of desire as necessarily pathological, and in exhorting individuals to a smooth and hyperfunctional sexuality, is seen, I think, by the feminist critique as in some way having done the dirty work that pornography and post-feminism have also been doing. And so for the feminist critique, representing female desire as inherently fractious and reticent, as nowhere near as robust or reliable as a society drowning in pornography would like, in fact forms part of an urge to slow a rampant sexual culture down. So the critique of the pharmaceutical future is very significantly about our present moment. But I think it's also significantly, though more covertly, about the past, and specifically about psychiatry's past, and more specifically about its psychoanalytic and Freudian past. So Freud, for contemporary psychiatry, often figures as the kind of non-scientific prehistory of the field before things really got kind of serious and modern. Psychoanalytic theory that deals in unconscious motives, in defenses mounted against unconscious feelings such as anxiety or envy or desire, is not easily measured or tested. And from the 1960s onwards, a mounting critique of psychoanalysis within science, medicine, psychiatry, philosophy, and popular culture really came to a head. But Freud has also been a very problematic figure, to say the least, for feminism, and particularly for the feminism that has infused critiques of medicine and psychiatry in the West. So Kate Millett, for example, saw Freud as beyond question the strongest individual counter-revolutionary force in the ideology of sexual politics, and I think many people then and now would agree. Psychoanalysis has been critiqued for having a phallocentric epistemology, for a kind of authoritarian herding into pathologizing categories of individuals who are then subjected to coercive forms of treatment for aberrations such as homosexuality or feminism itself or clitoral orgasms, etc. And it's true that in psychoanalysis, the risk is that in the name of the unconscious, various motives can be attributed to patients by therapists with impunity and without any means of critical rejection. So the key here is the unconscious. And the fact that symptoms can express feelings of which a sufferer is not consciously aware. And this possibility, the possibility that a patient does not know him or herself, the possibility that we never really know quite what it is that we want, and the possibility that our bodies can thwart us unconsciously, expressing feelings that we cannot voice otherwise. These possibilities are, I think, what is in fact crucial to preserve from psychoanalysis, and they are the things that are tiptoed around in the literature on female sexual dysfunction. So this kind of non-knowability of ourselves to ourselves, and therefore to our therapists and doctors, is the thing about which both pharmaceutical psychiatry and the feminist critique of that psychiatry are very anxious, having both emerged as they did from the kind of post-war rejection of Freud. I have heard and read people say in responses to this kind of field, to say, oh, for instance, a woman who feels no desire, that that woman has simply internalized a pressure to have sex. I've heard people and read people say that in the case of women who experience pain during sex and who are distressed about that pain, well, just don't have sex if it causes you pain. But I don't think that's enough. I think this stopping short of engaging with the feeling, with what kind of work a feeling and a physical sensation might be doing, is an index of a kind of limited ability to think about human behavior, to think about bodily sensations, as having a depth and a history which it might be fruitful to explore. So the question for me is how we speak with empathy and curiosity about sexual suffering and all the forms it can take, given a well-founded and necessary skepticism about what diagnostic categories do. We don't really know ourselves. We're not always the best judge of our own sufferings. Our symptoms can take surprising forms, and we may be very invested in not listening to them. I think that we're all in search, in lifelong search, of ways of being in our bodies and with our bodies, whatever those bodies are, that feel fruitful, exhilarating, and peaceful, and that can be extraordinarily difficult. So I think that anxiety about future sex, the future sex that we individually will have, and the future sexual landscape, especially in relation to technology, is not an unfounded anxiety. I think these are serious worries. But I, for one, do not want a critique of psychiatry that has to deny our unknowability to ourselves or to deny the difficulty of ever figuring out what it is that we want in the realm of sex. And I think that we won't be able to approach women's sexual difficulties, or men's for that matter, with compassion, nor articulate an adequate critique of opportunistic pharmaceuticals unless we recalibrate our relationship to the unconscious and to the insights of psychoanalysis, which at its core understands quite how much we do not understand. Thanks.
Thank you. I think we can include Fern in that applause as well. I should encourage you to applause gratuitously. That's such a sinewy and thoughtful position and a paper. And as I understand it, your argument is that that feminist critique of those pharmaceutical and medical models of desire, even though its heart is in the right place, ends up reinscribing certain accounts of female sexuality. Mm-hmm. And that the real kicker in your argument is that they share a hostility to psychoanalytical accounts of sexuality. So, and I sense that, particularly in the end of your paper, that this is something you want to re-inject into the discussion. And maybe this is a counterpoint to the discussion of intimacy, Fern's passionate defence of intimacy, and Kate's idea of the body that's supplanted by the robot, that the psyche has a place in sex too. How are you envisaging this? What's the future, the psychoanalytical future, if not Freud?
Well, I think part of it is Freud.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I think that Freud is such a contested figure because you can find everything in Freud. You know, it's a bit like the Bible, and he sort of rewrote and reformulated and tweaked so many of his theories over the course of his writing life in such a way that it's hard to know what Freud thought. And then, of course, you have the huge history of the kind of taking up of Freud by all kinds of people, some of whom were terrible people who did really want to suppress female sexuality in particular. So the kind of, you know, the architecture that you're dealing with when you're talking about psychoanalysis is so unwieldy and complicated. But I certainly feel that in the kind of post-60s and 70s era, where Freud was really, or not Freud so much as the kind of figure of Freud, a sort of caricatured and distorted figure of Freud, was so vilified and rendered kind of inadmissible. I think for certain versions of feminism, that inadmissibility of the strangeness of the psyche and the fact that if there's one area that we are not in control of, it's sex. And if there's one area where strange and disturbing and frightening things can happen within our own thoughts, let alone what we do with our bodies, it's sex. And, you know, and there are plenty of feminist theories and thinkers who embrace that and who have formulated very inspiring kind of engagements with psychoanalysis. But I certainly feel that in the kind of current conversation around this material in particular, the investment in not looking at the past, and it's also an investment in not looking at the past of feminism, because there's a kind of denial about different versions of feminism as well as, you know, contemporaneously. Of course, there are so many kinds of feminism. But the investment in this particular area, in not looking at what was an incredibly painful period for women in relation to psychoanalysis, I think is irresponsible. And, you know, there are so many liberatory and radical tools in Freud.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know,
I wonder
if in there with a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, that's true. And it behooves us to go and work that out ourselves. I wonder if the difficulty with that question you can never answer, what does a woman want, is that the model of female desire can't just be the inverse or correlative to male desire. And the other person I thought of as you were speaking was of Wolf, not of a room of one's own, but a libido of one's own, if you like. That Wolf says, you know, for a woman to write a novel, she has to find her own language. It's not enough mm-hmm. to write in the language of men, and then you have a dilemma. But in Freudian or psychoanalytical terms, a model of female desire can't just be equal to male desire. Mm-hmm. It has to be different to it, too. We need a libido of our own.
Yeah, and part of the problem is that a lot of the discussions in the kind of medical and psychiatric literature are trying to formulate an idea of female sexuality so much in relation not just to male sexuality but to an idea of male sexuality that is often not problematized in itself. So this, you know, there's a kind of contrast being made, you know, us kind of very emotional, labile, psychosexual creatures in contrast to the kind of mechanically reliable men. Well, you know, the history of sexuality shows us that male sexuality is just as much in need of interrogation and also in need of psychological interrogation as female sexuality. So that kind of foil is not serving men or women well, I think.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, if, and this will come bring us to Kate, that whether this contemporary model of not a dispassionate sex, but Tinder sex or online sex, distance learning sex, is one that is one that is safe, because it's a form of safe sex, because the psyche can be detached or seems to be detached from it, because those encounters are so rapid and meaningless. So if we re-inject the psyche into sexual encounters, maybe we're scared to do that, but if we do, there's a hornet's nest as well. Mm. Safe sex is without the psyche, or the damage of the unconscious too. There could be danger if we start to think about how the psyche is implicated in sex again. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you think that. It's always worth kicking Freud's hornet's nest.
I think that's an unfair thing to say, that just because it's casual, it's meaningless. Yeah, I think that does a lot of disservice to people who don't go down the route of a monogamous relationship. I think it's perfectly possible to have a consensual non-monogamous relationship where this forms part of your sex life and yet is meaningful and is interesting. So I think that's
I'm sure that's right. But maybe I mean that it might be a deception to ourselves, a self-deception, that we think that those encounters are meaningless, but actually the psyche is always involved in when you're swiping left and right. But we might tell ourselves that this is a safer, dispassionate form of sex, but the unconscious is always there, right?
It's I don't think it's us. I think it's culture has informed us in this idea that we're supposed to have monogamous relationships.
Yeah.
And it's discounted the casual, it's discounted that sex itself can be the connection, can be the intimacy, can be on every level what you connect to.
Yeah. Do either of you have any questions for Catherine?
I'm actually going to address it.
Fabulous. This is going so seamlessly. Let's get Kate.
Okay, so sort of moving on from that, because one of the things that started me off down the route of sex robots, which sounds incredibly tabloid frenzy, and often is, it comes from my interest in cognitive systems and in AI. So I've worked in artificial intelligence on looking at cognition and looking at human cognition and how we can think about building cognition in an artificial intelligence, which may not look human. But one of the really interesting things is that sex is completely left out of the research, which is strange because it's such a goal-oriented behaviour, and goal-oriented behaviour is one of the things that drives things like artificial intelligence. So we have the very classical AI approach that is an agent, an artificial intelligence needs to aim towards something, food or energy or replication, in which case humans will do that through sex, through their sexual behaviour. But also from, that's quite an old-fashioned AI approach, but from a more recent, inactive, embodied approach, sex is a social construct where we're embodied. You don't get more embodied than having sex, and it's cementing social relationships. And even if it's disembodied, even if you're in a different place from the person that you're having sex with over VR, for example, it's still about the body. And so you're getting all these responses happening. And so I was interested in what's going on cognition-wise when people are sexually aroused. You've got things, you know, you've got hormones flooding the brain, you've got dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin, you've got all of these things kicking off. How does that affect the way we think? So that led into my work on sex robots. And last week there was a bit of a tabloid frenzy because we announced we were hosting this conference at Goldsmiths, Love and Sex with Robots, at which point the Daily Express said that we were hosting a festival where we were going to tell people how to have sex with robots. I'm really sorry, I'm going to disappoint you all. Everyone is welcome to come along, but it's not a festival, and we will not be teaching people how to have sex with robots. We're much more highbrow than that. But this is very interesting because actually, and it ties into both Farron and Catherine's work, this goes way back. And before I became a computer scientist, I was an archaeologist, and it's one of the reasons I like looking at technological development over long periods of time. And we have dildos being found. 28,000 years ago, people were using dildos. Okay, sex toys have been around, so long. And the sex robot trope actually starts back in Greek, back at the start of history, back in Greek myth and legend, where you have things like Pygmalion, who created a sculpture out of ivory, a statue that who was pure and this wonderful woman that he could create himself and brought to life through kiss, through sexual behaviour. The story of Laodamia, whose husband died in battle, and she created a bronze version of him, which she took to her bed and interacted with. That's the actual words used. And Pandora, who was an artificial intelligence created by the gods. So you have all this stuff that's happening, that these tropes that begin then, and they follow right through. And throughout sci-fi, we see it coming up through novels, through films. I mean, Metropolis, one of the early films, you have the seductive female robot. And you keep getting this seductive female robot. Ex Machina, for example. And on TV today, Westworld and the new series of Humans, you see this happening again and again. You have this beautiful female robotic creature. There's always something a bit dystopian about it. There's always something that's going to go wrong because we see these robots as other. So we have the machine as other, you just know it's going to go bad. And part of that is, you know, what is our relationship with machines? What is our relationship with technology? And just how comfortable are we with something else having control? I think that's really interesting. The state of the art today is that there are companion robots out there. This is the non-sexual side of it. There are companion robots out there. They work in hospitals, in nursing homes. They don't look particularly android. They don't look particularly like humans. But they can lift and carry people. They can have telepresence machines that can talk to people. Emotional robots like SoftBank's Pepper robot. It establishes an emotional connection with you. And they're all very basic. You know, we don't have machine consciousness yet. People are working towards it. So these are all based on responses and a bit of machine learning where it takes in data and extrapolates into a new response. So in terms of sex robots, what we've got are basically mechanized sex dolls, right? The real dolls, things like that. They're nearly always female dolls. They're created by men, for men, straight men. It's an entirely heteronormative approach. And
what do they look like?
They don't look quite the way they're marketing them. They market this beautiful, you know, this picture of a beautiful scantily clad woman, and then you get a kind of a rubberized shot mannequin. They don't do anything for me. There are actually male versions as well, but I think they're more going for a market for gay men rather than for women, and basically, it is a big problem in tech that much of the tech we use today is designed by men for men. And it goes right through from smartphones, pacemakers, seatbelts, all the kinds of things you can think of that happen that we have in everyday life. Because we have this issue in tech of it being heavily male-dominated, and it's what was termed the sea of dudes in artificial intelligence, where it's shaping our technology for the future. Our artificial intelligence are being shaped by a community of predominantly white men. And how that actually, what effect that eventually has long term, is very interesting. If we extrapolate, is it going to be in that, are we forming these in the shape of ourselves? So the sex is all very much penis and vagina, straight sex. So that's a reflection of tech in general. So when I started looking into the sex robot thing, I was very interested in a number of, because it sounds hilarious on the surface, and it is. I mean, it's fun. It's fun to talk about. But actually, there are serious ethical implications from it. There really are. So straight away, there's the issue of law. And the most pressing one is data. So recently, there's a woman in Chicago who's suing WeVibe, which is a smart vibrator. I love that there are smart vibrators. A smart vibrator, and it stores data. It stores temperature data, usage data, frequency of use, all that kind of thing. And she didn't know that data was being collected. They didn't make it, and pardon the pun, explicit enough. They didn't make it clear to her or clear to any of their users that data was being stored. So she is now suing them, saying that they're storing information she didn't want. And this is a big problem. Data sharing is a big problem. And a lot of us will sign up and tick the boxes just so we can use the technology. It goes for fitness trackers, goes for smart TVs, whatever. So who gets that data from our sex robots if we're using it? What's going to be done with it? This is this is stuff that we may have to sign up to and sign our rights away. The other thing that's very pressing, so the short-term and long-term issues, because short-term are what we can do with the technology now, and long-term, what happens when we have a sentient machine. But short-term, in terms of things like, what happens if someone makes a child sex robot? And this is problematic. There are laws against making computer-generated images of child abuse. And recently, a few months ago, there was someone in Canada, I think, that was prosecuted for owning a child sex doll. And there are two arguments to this. And the first is that, yes, this is awful. This is a gateway to exploitation. It's this escalation hypothesis. And that by creating such a thing, it will lead to further offences and abuse of children. But the other argument is that perhaps this can be used as an outlet. Perhaps this is a way of dissipating sexual urges towards children. It's difficult. Virtual reality has been used for therapy for sex offenders, where it was following therapy, it was being used to check whether or not treatment had been successful. So you can put a sex offender into a virtual environment and find out whether or not they're being aroused virtually, so you don't have to do that outside in the streets. And we know that also sex has got a lot of health benefits. It's really good for our well-being, psychologically good, physically good. So we could say that perhaps we can use these machines as a form of therapy itself, just everyday therapy, to boost people's well-being, perhaps sexual surrogates for people who aren't able to go out and meet people. And the manufacturers of real dolls say that that's one of the things that they do. They say that they sell it to people who may be disabled, for example, and cannot get out and meet people. And so they have this companion doll in this case. And one of the things that I'm interested in the future, if we did have sentient machines, what happens around consent? Mm-hmm. What happens if we create any kind of sentience, not necessarily human? What happens if we have a machine that can think for itself? Should it have the right to turn us down? Should it have its own bodily autonomy? I think that's a really interesting question.
I want you to answer that question. Really, what happens to consent when you build a creature that is not capable of consent, when you delete consent from an equation?
That's a really, really difficult question. It really is, and I think it needs something that needs a lot of looking into. But it applies not just in sex robots, but in robotics in general, and there's a lot of discussion around this, because if you create, for example, a worker robot, does it suddenly become a slave if it's got, or is its desire to please you? Can you, if you program it to please you, is that enough to make it happy? There are big questions around this. And I think one of the one of the other things I find interesting is the idea of gender, in that we automatically have this tendency to gender machines. We assign, you know, this is a male robot, this is a female robot, based on some really spurious ideas, through signals, through the way it's formed or shaped. There is nothing to say that a sex robot has to look human. We're falling into the trap of thinking that's what it's going to look like. It may be, but when we went out and asked people in the street, when we went and did a bit of a vox pop, we had mixed reactions. We had people saying, oh, not if it looked human. And then with other people saying, oh, yeah, but only if it had a proper face and everything. And you think, you know, I would love to do a large-scale study to find out what people actually want if they were to have sex with a robot. And sex tech today, sex tech is a $15.25 billion industry, right? It's one of the biggest industries worldwide. This is going to happen, whether we like it or not, okay? Sex tech is getting to that stage. It's getting more and more advanced. Someone's going to come out with those machines. Someone is going to end up making them, and they're going to make a fortune. The porn companies have already driven technology hugely in terms of things like the internet. It was porn that drove streaming video online. It was porn that drove credit card transactions online. And now we're seeing it as content for VR. And it's big bucks, and it's just going to keep going that way. So I think now is the time to get in and decide, what is it that we actually want from this? Are we going to go down the same route of this very exploitative porn route that we see today? Or can we change it so that we have a much more positive approach to it, an inclusive approach to it, and much more diverse?
Fantastic. Thank you. Maybe I'm going to try and broaden out the questions to get you both in, and get all three of you in, and then I can see there are questions about sex robots and other things in the audience. But maybe we'll start with this question of pornography. What's the future of pornography in the next 20 years? Is this new technology a broadening of sexual desire, or is it a narrowing that all the robots are going to be, I don't know, 5'11" and a size 0? Is this a broadening or a narrowing of our sexual desire? Is the technology and the pornography liberatory, or is it repressive again?
I think it's currently stuck in the same mould as it has been. I think there's a chance, with any technology that comes along, we have a chance to shape it. It's just that it's currently reflecting social mores at the moment, and we're stuck in this kind of, what Fern was saying about moving from the erotic to the pornographic, I think there is a lot of that, and I think we should be challenging it.
Well, sure. The moment you started talking about how they were saying, well, I don't want a face, or I do want a face, the first thing that came into my head is, we see now on so many of the things like YouPorn, XTube, RedTube, all of the free pornographic websites, is often their videos just of the sex act, just of the organs. They're not of the body, they're not of the face. And is it that people are accessing these images rather than, I want to have sex with a human, I want that intimacy, that connection of another human being, that we're fixating on just body parts?
It's really interesting you say that, because I was talking to a friend of mine about this, and he said, do you ever notice that when you're sexting, everyone will send pictures, they'll happily swap pictures of their genitals, but they'll never put their face in the picture. I think, okay, obviously that's going to be for privacy reasons as well, but people are much more happy to share a picture of their genitals than they are of their face with, you know, featuring in the same picture.
But is that going to be something awful? Are we going to see sex robots that are headless? that are just a body, that you're just creating a physical desire, and you're losing that connection to an actual person, something that actually is a connection. And it's one of the things that that Catherine was talking about, this constant preoccupation with the naturalization of lowering female desire, which I thought was fascinating, because I completely agree, and I think we've seen it. You can almost put a pin in it happening in the Victorian period when Richard Crawford Elling publishes Psychopathia Sexualis, which is a catalogue. It's really the first catalogue in our history that outlines sexual desire, sexual fetish, all the different types of what you can be and what you can experience. It says what's okay, and it says what isn't, and it has the one sentence that always sticks in my head. This is in 1886 or 88, I think. Women has but little sensual desire. And this becomes the manual on which all psychosexual therapy, every idea is inherently holding on to this perception. And I don't know how we move forward, because if technology is being governed by men And if the pharmaceutical companies are arguing that women have very limited sexual desire still, even now, even 100 years later, how do we hold on to any hope that female sexual desire and intimacy and sex as a connection is ever going to become a dominant form of culture rather than a subculture expressed only artistically, which is what I think we've had previously.
One of the things I find heartening is that the sex tech industry, a lot of the startups are run by women. Wow. And there's an increasing interest from women being involved in sex toys and sex tech and developing them and developing new forms of them. And I find that, I think, through all the crap that we've waded through to get to this stage, there are a lot of problems with, you know, feminism, internecine wars at the minute. But at the same time, we now have the language to be able to move into that sphere and start talking about what we want. And so I think that's hopefully a positive thing.
But I suppose one thing that I'd want to say is that we don't... Well, I think that we think we know what's going on sometimes when people are interacting with technology, when actually probably we don't. So I think an interesting example is GIFs. Is that how you say it?
Controversial.
I feel that should be how one says it, because GIFs just sounds too sexual, so surely it's more sense of a GIF. So I remember reading some really interesting research into what women look at in pornography, and the research is controversial because it's very hard to track the gender of people looking at pornography. But to the extent that it can be done well, there is research that suggests that women sort of disproportionately look at GIFs. And I find that very interesting, and I found myself wondering why, and that's certainly true of my own porn usage, is it's quite GIF-oriented and sort of Tumblr-oriented. And in fact, Helen Hester has written some interesting stuff about this, and she's argued, and this kind of makes sense to me, that there's something about the kind of, that very sort of curated realm of pornography where people are making Tumblr sites that are kind of oriented to a particular aesthetic and that, you know, use tags. I mean, all porn sites use tags, but where tags can kind of help people, and perhaps especially women, navigate a world which, you know, a lot of the world of pornography feels hostile to women. So when you're interacting with pornography as a woman, you are having to try and find a path that works for you. And Helen Hester suggests that what the GIF allows you is kind of against the cliched idea that what women like in pornography is nice erotic stories with, you know, but romantic kind of erotic stories where the guy's so nice and then you make love. That actually, what the GIF allows you is to get rid of all that narrative. I mean, to the extent that one can ever get rid of narrative, the GIF allows you just to look at that particular little wobble or that particular little that is the thing that gets you off without having to be presented with some cliched, often totally misogynistic, but also just aesthetically naff scenario that most pornography indulges in. And that makes sense to me, that actually, you know, if you kind of... I mean, all the kind of journalistic clichés about sex and technology are always kind of the things to avoid, but, you know, the idea that looking at pornography for women is kind of inherently problematic because it's some kind of capitulation or, you know, a sort of complicity in a problematic industry, which, you know, it is problematic because it's an industry. Of course, it's problematic. But that we can have a much more kind of fine-grained approach to that, which is how are people individually trying to navigate the kind of aesthetic, embodied experience of technology in such a way that they can try to divest it of what feels problematic. And so for me, that example of what might be going on with GIFs that chimes certainly with my feeling about pornography is an example of how it's really difficult. It's like annoyingly difficult to know what's going on when people are interacting with pornography or technology of any kind.
I was thinking about how I've read lots of gay literary porn. There's lots of gay, big gay, Edmund White's Our Young Man. It's filthy. Amazing. Mm. And I was thinking how that literary writing about female desire is good. Literary female... there'll be a reading list. But literary female desire seems quite antiquated. Like Pauline Riage or Anais Nin. That writing seems antiquated, as you say. It feels It falls into traps about masochism, and it falls into traps about victimhood sometimes, and sometimes it feels trite, and that maybe one of our acts of resistance, women with desire, is to divest ourselves of narrative, is to go in for the kill.
Yeah,
I think that seems really interesting to me. Fern, you want to say something?
Well, it was your description of Nin as a trap of masochism.
Well, yeah.
And I think one
she's
of the issues...
She's become such a cliché.
Well, I don't know. I know that reading Alice Nin for the first time in my early 20s was revelatory, to find a woman who could write so openly about sex and about different types of sex. And I think one of the issues we have with feminist discussions of sex is we seem to come to the table with a decision of what's good and what's bad and what's okay. So to be a feminist and to be into BDSM or a supporter...
Yes.
is immediately viewed as, oh, no, you can't be, because those two things don't work. And we've, as feminists, tried so hard to theorise sex and to psychoanalyse women's motivation for sex, we've almost forgotten that sex is sex, and everyone has their own kink, everyone has their own fetish, whether it's that you like missionary and you like to do it at 6 p.m. on a Friday... That's what you like, and it's just as it should be just as acceptable as someone who has the most extreme fetish that's between two consenting adults. You know, whenever I take part in feminist discussion, there always seems to come a moment where we are already self-regulating what's acceptable.
Yeah,
and I think that is one of the earliest issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're always, feminists are chasing our tails often about how free we think our sexual freedom is and or not.
Yeah.
Let's open out to the floor. Our roving mics are out. There are lots of questions. Should we take three we'll have a threesome. So the lady in the green there, and the gentleman there, and the lady in the corner there, and then I'll go to the back ranks.
Hi, can you hear me? I'm interested in equality and how that plays out with the dynamic of desire and attraction. So studies have shown that in a dual-earning household, if, say, looking at a man and a woman married, if the woman earns more money, they have less sex. So as a society, we're moving toward equality, but it's not innately what attracts us sexually to one another oftentimes. So what are your thoughts on that?
Okay, great. The second question was the gentleman there.
Is there such thing as an empathy involved?
In sex?
Well, I mean, some kind of connection. I mean, some telepathy. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what a woman, I don't know what a woman's thinking, you know, for us, you know, it's difficult. You know?
Yeah, you're not alone. Freud said that. You're not alone.
we're discussing these things. When we become analytical, we become less sexually desirable.
Okay.
We have less sexual desire. It's a strange thing.
Great. Oh, we'll send out a questionnaire and find out your levels of libido after this. Good question, though. And the lady over there, and then we'll get some responses.
Hello. Well, I'm involved in robots also, different kind of robots, agricultural robots. But I have a little robot at home. It's a little Hoover thing, and I'm very attached to it. And I'm really fond of it. And I would like to explore the nature of attachment, I mean, nature of love even, you know, what it is that makes you attached to a thing like that, and which is going to be more and more relevant if you have more conscious robots.
That works nicely with that question, doesn't it? Let's go to the first question, which was about what are we looking for if we're having less sex with people who earn more than us, or what are we looking for? What's the nature of equality?
So when the woman earns more, it's
really right. I mean, I think you know that's about equality, but it's about inequality. It's about gender inequality. It's about the fact that we grow up with norms of gender that make it difficult for men to countenance being in a relationship with a woman who earns more money. That's about norms of gender. It's not really about sex. It's about status and power.
Yeah. There's economy is the term as well, right? That there is a financial economy and a libido economy, and those for Freud that economy is it's one. It's just, you know, libido is more than just sex. So it's a much more complex notion of the psyche, doesn't he?
Well, it's Caminos said this in the 60s that that what happened, what you see in the 19th century when capitalism takes off, is that sex becomes industrialized and it becomes an exchange of so that your man's semen almost becomes his monetary exchange, which is why masturbation is seen as bad, because you're wasting money, you're wasting semen. And I think the connection between capitalism and the economy and earning is one that has become an increasing sexual theory as we live in a more urbanised and a more modern world. Whereas what the theorists would have us believe prior to this is that actually everyone was having great sex and it was all wonderful and it was all equal and no one cared because women didn't earn anything anyway, so why did it even count? But I get very cross and very resentful of this idea that women don't have sex drives. And I think it's such a dominating influence in our culture and in all the industries that deal with telling us about sex. It drives me mad because it's not the experience that I know. It's not the experience that I know of the women that I talk to. And this constant idea that men have one sex drive and women have another, and we have to focus on the female sex drive because that's where all the problems lie. It drives me crazy.
The second and third question was about attachment, the language of attachment. How do we describe attachment between humans and between humans and robots? I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I find that really fascinating. And there have been a lot of work on this. And one of the ideas, quite a commonly held idea, is that you can only have attachment if it's mutual. And I think that's completely wrong. We get attached to things all the time. Children get attached to teddy bears, you know. And I'm incredibly attached to my phone, which is currently over there. I feel a bit lost without it.
Anxiety.
I know. I mean, we're so used to it. Phones are a really good example. They've been a disruptive. Smartphones are a disruptive technology that has changed society hugely. You walk down the street, people are holding their phone, walking. People are at bus stops looking at their phone. People are on the tube looking at their phone. This is something that is completely pervasive now in our society, and yet it's a very intimate piece of technology that we don't like to share with people. We keep it close, we're attached to it. It's the first thing we reach for in the morning, it's the last thing we put down at night. Well, in my case it is, because I have a problem. But you know, the phone is an example of that. We get attached to it, but we also form relationships with objects, and I think that it doesn't have to be reciprocated in order to have this attachment. And I think we can get attached to mechanical machines. We can get attached to machines and mechanical objects. But it's been written about in terms of in relation to sex as well, that surely it's something you have to have a connection with the other person. You have to worry about their pleasure in order to get pleasure yourself. I think that's certainly a part of it, but it's not the be all and end all. You can still have perfectly satisfactory sexual pleasure without having another person or without having a connection with them. It's perfectly possible, I think.
Well, the idea that that what do you do when you can't find someone to have sex with is one that we see from ancient culture when you're talking about the sex dolls. We also know there was an amazing article by Melissa Snow on the fact that Gawain and the Green Knight, the Arthurian legend, is actually about actually has a sex doll in it. The woman in the centre of this has a sex doll in her chamber that she talks about. And we know the Victorians also had sex dolls. We know that their discussion of sex dolls came from Dutch wives, which was that men in the merchant navy often... stories of the Dutch merchant navy would get together a collection of rags in the bowels of the ship and sort of make it woman or human shaped, and that would be the place, their outlet while they were at sea for 9 months. So the idea that you can get attached to inanimate objects, I think, is we see throughout history. Yeah. So,
but also, I mean, we do also get attached to, you know, cats who don't care about our attachment to them. So if you can love a cat, why not love a robot who might respond to you stroking it, or, you know, it might purr or something. I mean,
Well, there have been studies on the companion robots. I don't know if you know about it. There's one called Paro. It's a little seal cub. And Para's very, very cute. It's a little, that size, very fluffy whiskers. And
kind of, like a Furby.
Yeah, it kind of is. And it's just this little seal. And it kind of makes noises, right? And oh, so cute. Everybody who sees Para just falls in love with him. I'm already gendering him. I'm going, Para, him. It's a male robot. Para is genderless. But people get really attached to it. They put it in nursing homes in Japan, and old people got really, really attached. So you've got this ideal pet that doesn't need feeding and doesn't shit everywhere. And you can stroke it and it responds, yeah. And they get attached. And there have been other examples, I think, from the Netherlands, where they put a robot into a nursing home or into a care home, and they got the people to talk to this robot, and they knew, the people knew it was a robot. They're like, this is a robot, they're gonna interact with you. And it ended up with the old people showing them pictures of their family to the robot. Because they had just kind of befriended it so much that they were happy to interact with it as if it was a real person, which kind of goes back to this idea of the sex doll as if it were a real person.
I mean, I suppose what I find really interesting about the kind of conversations about robots is like what they're being contrasted with, right? So part of what you're saying is that, in fact, if we draw this very stark distinction between the robot and the human, there's something problematic in that, yeah. Because actually we're all cyborgs anyway, right? Yeah. Mm. Haro said it decades ago, we all have these prosthetics now attached to us in the shape of the technologies that we use, and increasingly that, you know, enter the body and record everything in the body. But I also think there's interesting questions about, in terms of anxieties about sex robots, and I do think, you know, there are anxieties, as you've kind of pointed out. Some of that anxiety, I think, does a really problematic thing of implicitly comparing the sex robot to a sex worker in a way that is supposed to make us feel that there's, well, it's supposed to make us assume that there's something already dehumanized about the figure of the object that works in a sexual way in relation to us humans. Mm. So I think some of the campaigns against sex robots actually capitalize on a presumed kind of dehumanization of the figure of the sex worker, who already obviously has no agency and has no personhood. And we don't want to be, you know, extending that non-personhood of sex workers to the rest of our lives and to these robots, do we? You know, so there's a kind of rhetorical hostility to the figure of the sex worker implicit in some of those discussions that is kind of disturbing, which isn't to say that there aren't problems to do with sex robots.
Right, but I have the same stance. I do think that's problematic with that idea of going against the sex worker because of the sex worker position. I think that you're right. It removes the agency from the sex worker, and it's also a very male approach as well. Mm. It's not a chance to.
Let's get at least two more questions. The lady in the black and white there, and a very really enthusiastic hand up there with the in the white top there.
My question is again still talking about robots and technology. What would be of the future, in a future that we're going to have robots, machines, but also even algorithms and biotech that understand feelings, our own feelings, our own emotions, our own sexual desires, much better than we would know ourselves and people around us would know?
Yeah, that's an optimistic, I think, maybe idea of what we can do, but a good one. Good question.
Sorry about the enthusiastic hand. I'm just really short, so I have to kind of... I was just wondering whether you think there's a danger of excluding a generation from the debate when it comes to technology and sex, because there's a American journalist called Nancy Jo Sales who's done an extensive kind of research into the effect of social media on teenage girls in America. And it's this movement towards hyper-perfection, which you've already touched on talking about the robots and humans, and that idea of an aesthetic perfection that we're moving towards. And I wonder if, when we're still not talking about the sexual desire of teenage girls and how to address that, you know, you're going to get teenage boys who already are dehumanizing girls, messaging, you know, sliding into their DMs and saying, send me a nude. And surely it's moving towards a point where, you know, a teenage boy can just say to a sex robot or whatever we're moving towards, you know, he can tell her to flash and she'll flash. She's not going to say, no, I'm not comfortable with that. And you've still got all these teenage girls who are kind of going, well, I have to now keep up with a sex robot, never mind, like, you know, however many girls on social media that are already perfect. And there's, you know, yeah.
Let's get some answers.
Oh, I think an instant answer to that is the issue of education and how poor our sex education in this country. I mean, I asked on Twitter before we got here, when was the last time anyone saw a birth control advert in mass media, in mainstream media? Can you remember the last time you saw either a condom advert or an advert for anything? I can't. And the reaction from everyone in the UK was, I don't remember the last time I saw something. Victorians had condom adverts in their mainstream newspapers in the 1890s. That's how much things have changed and how little we are educating people on things like empathy and intimacy and communication and how to ask what you want, how to express what you like, how not to be intimidated if someone asks you to do something you're not comfortable with. And we've almost, in this shift from a culture of eroticism, which is about a shared experience, into a culture of pornography, which is about the individual experience, into getting what you want, not sharing this connection. I think one of the huge issues is that we're no longer educating people about sex. We're no longer educating people to connect. We're just saying, get what you want and get out. And pornography gives us that very quickly. Not that I am anti-pornography. I think in many ways it actually can be a really good teaching tool. But the way we use it, how it's accessible, you can go on Twitter and find GIFs, find videos for pornography within 30 seconds. You can do the same on Tumblr, you can do the same on all social media platforms, but it's not being, there's no one there saying, but also intimacy. Mm. Everyone's just focused on it just as the physical act, and I think an awful lot of the conversations about sex robots as well is focusing purely on what can this robot do for me physically, and don't go into what we've been talking about today, which has been really amazing, about the intimate connection or maybe even the emotional side of things.
I think it also goes back to what Catherine was saying about the power struggle, because it's a very uneven power struggle, and mm-hmm. young men are winning out in terms of what is offered to them, and women, young women are not getting that. Mm-hmm. They're not getting the opportunities. That's not to say that they automatically want to be ordering men to flash at them or anything like that, because God, no. we get enough dick pics as it is. To have that opportunity to ask for what they want, I think that's definitely a power thing and something that we address.
I suspect we're not going to be able to answer that question about algorithms, although it's a fascinating one. But can I get you to give me like a final... These are sexual metaphors, aren't they? A one-line whip, two-line whip, as to what do we do to equalise sex in the future? What do we do to redress that balance that you've said is... I think, what do we do?
We have equal development. We have development input from a very equal and diverse group now. I think we need to get in now in terms of equality and diversity in order to influence tech in the future.
Influence tech. Catherine?
I mean, I guess coming back a bit to that question over there, I mean... Obviously, the question of consent is just so crucial, but more than just consent, because I think the bar is low. You know, we set the bar low when we talk about consent, and it shouldn't just be an issue of, you know, are you okay with me doing this? We should be aiming much higher for being able to talk about pleasure and also about vulnerability, because sex is this area where mastery and vulnerability are always vying, and unfortunately, in the kind of way that men are raised, the need to deny vulnerability, even though, you know, when you think about it, coming is a pretty vulnerable act. Mm-hmm. It's so ingrained in masculinity to kind of deny that, I think, in our kind of cultural tropes of masculinity. So I think that talking about consent, but pleasure and power and weakness, sex is also about weakness.
I would agree totally with Catherine. I think we need a re-education on eroticism and to bring that back into our sexual culture as a buffer against going too far towards detachment and towards individual experience rather than the joy that and the incredible connection that can come from a really good sex experience. because it does feel a little at the moment as if technology is being used to pass the buck. It's being used to make excuses for poor sexual connection between humans. And I think that's where we're falling down at the moment, culturally and sexually.
This was a great exhortation. Go forth and have great, informed, consensual sex. Can I ask you to join me in thanking our fabulous, fantastic, brilliant...